That's part of it, but it's not the narrative, it's the facts.
Indeed.
Facts that have to be dealt with, and of course the way they're presented is a significant element of that.
So we can agree that the narrative, as we are fed it, as we get it, is a fiction.
I wouldn't say it's a fiction. Well, you know, it's historical fiction. There's some relation to the facts, but presented through a highly distorting prism.
Yes, in a moment I'd like to come to the media's role in the telling of this story. But let me be specific to Ireland, because we are greatly concerned here about our relationship with the United States of America. It's a long, historic relationship. Many of our immigrants went to America. We feel affection and indeed gratitude to the United States. Yet in the present Middle East crisis, Shannon Airport is a stopover for U.S. troops. It may well have been used for extraordinary rendition flights, and people here are in their souls concerned about this. And I'm sure from the few days you've been with us, you understand their affection and respect for you as well. What are we to do? If politics is the art of the possible, what are our politicians to do in these circumstances?
Well, first, I'd like to suggest a slight correction. When you talk about the United States, there are really two different meanings to that term. One is the U.S. government. The other is the U.S. population. Governments and population are quite different entities. You mentioned that I was a radical critic. Actually, I'm a very conservative critic.
Yes.
My positions are pretty much the same as the majority of the population. But there's a huge gulf between public policy and public attitudes. So sympathy for a country, its culture, its society, that's one thing. Sympathy for the government is something quite different. Totalitarians identify them, but we shouldn't. And as far as Ireland's choices are concerned, they are very much like those of everyone else in the world. The U.S. government now is an enormously powerful and quite violent entity. And in a world that's where international affairs have a not slight resemblance to the mafia, yes, that means everyone has to pay attention. If you're living in a place which is run by a mafia don, you can't disregard what they may do, what he may do. So, yes, Ireland has difficult problems. Shannon's a case in point. And Irish simply have to ask whether they want to participate in take extraordinary rendition. I mean, that's just one of the most... I mean, that's just a fancy term for torture.
Yes, and
so
of course...
the question is whether you want to participate in torture. Well, okay, it's a choice you have to make. Are you afraid of the mafia don to the extent that you will participate in torture? Or refuse, which can be done. And in fact, the American population would mostly agree. In fact, so would Congress. But let's take the more complex question of use of Shannon for whatever military purposes it has been used for. As far as I know, that's rather obscure, but whatever it is, there comes the question, do we want to participate in what was called at Nuremberg the supreme international crime, which includes within it all of the evil that follows, namely the invasion of Iraq, which is a straight example of outright aggression with horrendous consequences. So I have to ask again, do we want to participate in it or not?
In your, and I take, and I'm sure our listeners will take, the distinction you make between the people of the United States and the governing elite in the United States, can we take it from what you've said, that democracy doesn't function in the United States?
We certainly can. In fact, it's one of the most serious problems in the world now, is a growing democratic deficit, as it's called. Formal democratic institutions, very high level of freedom, in fact, in some respects, the highest in the world. Protection of freedom of speech, for example, in the United States goes far beyond England or continent or any other country that I know of. Yes, we have to make it, but the fact is that these democratic institutions barely function. Say the elections last November. I mean, if those elections were taking place in an enemy state, we would just laugh.
Why?
Didn't take place in any serious sense.
Why precisely?
Well, public opinion happens to be studied in great detail in the United States, so we know what it is. It's not reported by the media, but there are extensive studies by the most prestigious institutions. Several of them were released right before the election. What they demonstrated was that both political, I won't go through the details, but they showed that on issue after issue, both political parties were far to the right of the population on very important issues. Now, how was the election run? Well, the elections in the United States are run by the public relations industry.
Yes, I want to get to that. I mean, the problem here is that you're alluding to would be surely that to become a candidate of either of the main parties, the Democratic or Republican Party, you would have had to have sold out, bought into things that were anti-democratic.
That's part of it. But yes, in fact, the election was a choice between two men born to wealth and privilege and political power, went to the same elite university, joined the same secret society where people are trained to be members of the ruling class, have a position within the political system because of the massive support they get from pretty much the same corporate and other institutions. But that's only a small part of it. When you get to the actual elections, they had about as much significance as television ads on selling toothpaste, which is not surprising because they're run by the same people.
Yes, so just to go back to that point about the society you referred to, the secret society, was that Yale University, I believe?
It's Skull and Bones at Yale University.
Can I ask you, somebody, a friend of mine in France that told me recently, someone who's in the media business, that all recent American presidents in living memory had been Freemasons. Do you know if that's true?
No, I doubt that at all. I think that's a
tough information.
Off the
radar screen. Yeah. Let me ask you then about in my lifespan, I'm 60 now. When I grew up, communism was the great evil. Before that, fascism. Before that again, Soviet communism. And therefore, it wasn't difficult for the United States of America and Britain and Western Europe to depict themselves as the good guys. So in the good guys versus bad guys narrative that we were sold at that point, it wasn't hard to depict the United States as a good guy. And communism and fascism were both defeated in their worst manifestations. You may correct me, of course, but let's take the two extremes, the Soviet Empire and the Nazi experiment, shall we call it. Had the United States of America not existed and Western European values as we know them not existed, what would have confronted totalitarian communism?
Well, first of all, you're talking about a narrative, which is correct. The relation between the narrative and history is quite slight. If you take a look at the events of the Cold War period, it's true that the United States and Russia were antagonists, but in a very strange sense. They were actually on the same side. Russia was the junior partner in a system of world domination, and the tacit agreement was that Russia could carry out whatever actions it did within its own domains. The West would scream about them but wouldn't do anything about them. And the United States could do with anything it wanted within its much vaster domains. And if you look at the events of the Cold War, within U.S. domains, there was just atrocity after atrocity under the pretext of defense against communism, which had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Yes,
it is a free society.
These were the death squads in Nicaragua. I want to ask you specifically.
That's the tiny part of it.
Yes.
I mean, there's a long record of overthrow of parliamentary governments, of support of international terrorism, of involvement in it, institution of neo-Nazi military dictatorships, all under the pretext of protection against communism. The tacit agreement was each side would let the other alone.
Yes.
That's in fact, if you ask why it's a very good thing that the Soviet Union collapsed. It was a monstrosity. But the facts are much different than what is described. Go into it if you like.
But yes, I would ask you this, Professor Chomsky. Is the kind of democracy we have in our Western societies not anything more than the least bad option?
No, there are much better options. You could have take, say, the United States again. I don't think it's outrageous to say that the United States could become as democratic as the second largest country in the hemisphere, Brazil. That's hardly a radical position. But in Brazil, they actually have elections in which the population can select and elect their own candidate. In this case, one of the more impressive figures in the world scene, a person of peasant background, a union leader, never had any higher education, strongly opposed by the highly concentrated media, a country with enormous inequality, a very brutal state, and so on. Nevertheless, they're able to elect a president. Not two rich boys who went to the same elite university. How could they do it? Because they have a functioning democracy. The Workers' Party, whatever you think about it, is not just a candidate-producing organization. It's an ongoing, active institution in which people participate. There are mass popular organizations like the Landless Workers Movement, maybe the most important in the world, which are constantly at work, and so on. That's the basis for democracy.
And interestingly, at this point, as Professor Chomsky, a lot of Latin and South America has actually taken a turn politically to the left.
Towards actual political participation by the mass of the population.
Yes.
It's not... Is what happens in the United States the least bad? Not at all. This is much better.
Let me ask you particularly about Colombia, because it has a resonance here also. We have had three Irishmen dubbed the Colombia Three. They were tried in Colombia, found not guilty in by that court, and then in a subsequent appeal, which wasn't at all very legal, they were found guilty. We also have one of our best investigative journalists, in fact, our best investigative journalist, suffering from some tyrannical behavior by our own government, all based on a narrative, a fiction about Colombia. You've written extensively about Colombia. The idea, the story we're told by our government is that Colombia is a fine place where FARC narco-terrorists are the problem, and the government's trying to get rid of them, and our people were working with the FARC terrorists, mm-hmm. and all of this stuff. Now, tell us about Colombia.
Well, there's another narrative, if you like, which
truth.
Is told by the church, by human rights organizations, by the actual record, which is almost diametrically opposed to that. Colombia has had the worst human rights record in the hemisphere for the last 15 years by a large measure. It's also the leading recipient of U.S. military aid by a large measure, and those two facts are correlated throughout a lot of history. The government, the overwhelming majority of the atrocities are carried out, and the State Department reports will tell you this, are carried out by the government and the paramilitaries, who are in such close alliance that Human Rights Watch describes the paramilitaries as the 6th division of the Colombian army. It has five official divisions and a 6th division.
And also the drugs.
Most of the drug traffic is done by the paramilitaries.
Yes.
And that's ignored because it's part of the government paramilitary apparatus that the United States supports.
And most of the drugs are consumed by the people of the United States, who is allegedly waging a government allegedly waging a war on drugs.
If you wrote a real source on this, the best is done by an Irish journalist, Hugh O'Shaughnessy,
yes.
who's just come out with another book which goes into this in great detail. So I won't talk about it.
Yes, we had him on our program actually.
Fine.
Recently.
Okay,
yes.
that's the truth, not the narrative. And yes, there is a drug problem in the United States, as throughout the world, and it is well known how to deal with it. By the government's own studies, the most cost-effective method is prevention and treatment, far better than police action or out-of-country action. But let's see what's happening in Colombia. I mean, there are plenty of drugs that are murderous. By far the worst is tobacco. I mean, just incomparably worse than hard drugs. Look at the figures. Suppose that Colombia were to carry out chemical warfare in Kentucky and North Carolina to wipe out tobacco crops. Would that be legitimate? I mean, it's outlandish. The United States is carrying out chemical warfare. I've seen it on the ground. Chemical warfare to destroy peasant agriculture, to drive peasants into urban slums. You see these people, their crops are destroyed, their children are dying, they have sores all over their hands, they're pleading for assistance. Poor peasant farmers in Kalka, where I happen to be, subjected to intensive chemical warfare carried out by U.S. mercenaries. That's what's DynCorp, which is the U.S. Farms out its terrorist activities. These are ex-military and so on flying planes to destroy crops and to clear the land so that the population, indigenous people, campesinos, Afro-Americans, will join the several million displaced persons, one of the largest in the world, and the land will be cleared for mining companies, foreign investors, oil drilling, monoculture, agribusiness, and so on. It'll also destroy the diversity. What does this have to do with drugs? I mean, the actual, yes, they're producing coca, partly because Colombia is a very rich country, potentially, but it has incredible inequality. I mean, you go to Bogota, it's, you know, beautiful. Take a look in the countryside, there's miserable poverty and oppression and violence. Yes, so peasants are driven to producing something that that'll enable them to survive. Now, Hugh O'Shaughnessy, in his book, makes a very interesting observation. He points out that the European Union subsidies for tobacco alone are greater than all funding for alternative crops in Colombia and other places. Well, that tells you something very significant about the drug war. It means that for Europe, subsidizing poisonous substances is far more important than enabling peasants to survive without producing coca. Draw the conclusions from that. Yes. Tells you something about the drug war.
When you spoke in Dublin on Tuesday night, you referred to the conflict in the Middle East at the moment, and you've referred in particular to the standoff with Iran over its nuclear program. And you said, whilst anybody, and I'm quoting you roughly, whilst anyone in their right mind wouldn't want to see Iran have a nuclear weapon, Iranians looking from their perspective would be crazy not to have a nuclear weapon.
Actually, to be clarified, I was quoting one of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, who pointed out that under present circumstances, Iran would be crazy not to develop nuclear weapons. If you want a more extensive discussion of this, I'd suggest this morning's Financial Times, which has a long article by Zelig Harrison, one of the leading specialists on the topic, who points out that Europe, under U.S. pressure, is refusing to implement the agreement made with Iran, which was, it's rarely reported here, that Iran would terminate its enrichment operations in return for a European agreement to deal with security issues. And that means primarily the threat to Iran by the United States and its offshoot Israel. Well, under U.S. pressure, Europe has refused to deal with that. Those were equivalent. And what Harrison points out is, well, here's a way to deal with the problem diplomatically, namely live up to your obligations. Stop threatening Iran with subversion, bombing, and so on, deal with security issues, then maybe you can approach the question of whether they should continue doing what they are doing, which so far is within the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Harrison goes on to make a more important point. He says the reason the Non-Proliferation Treaty is breaking down, is primarily because of the refusal of the nuclear powers to live up to their obligations. Now, he didn't say it, but the United States is far in the lead in refusal to live up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
But just elaborate slightly on that, Professor Chomsky. What are they not doing in terms
Article
of...
Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty states that the nuclear states must undertake good faith measures to eliminate nuclear weapons. That was underscored by the World Court about 10 years ago in a judgment making that a legal obligation for the nuclear states. Now, none of them have lived up to it, but the United States is alone in officially rejecting it. And there's a bargain in the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The bargain is that the non-nuclear states will not develop nuclear weapons. In return, the nuclear states will facilitate their obtaining means to develop nuclear energy and will eliminate their own nuclear weapons. Now, as Mohammed al-Baradei, the head of the international agency, pointed out, if one side doesn't live up to its bargain, the other side isn't going to either.
Okay, we're going to take an ad break now and half eight news bulletin, and we'll return with Professor Noam Chomsky after that. Welcome back to this special edition of The Breakfast Show on News Talk 106, and it's a great privilege and pleasure to have in the studio with us Professor Noam Chomsky, who's been in Dublin this week, and in front of large audiences he has been talking about his view of the world, which is unique, of course. He is one of the most respected dissenting voices in the Western world, and given that he teaches at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology and lives in the United States of America, is not an easy thing to be. Professor Chomsky, the media are pivotal, I would have thought, in our understanding of the modern world, its issues, and in this narrative we've been talking about that is only partly true. How important would reform of the media be in the United States? How closely is the media in the United States linked into corporate culture that is effectively the boss?
With one qualification, the same is true throughout the West.
Yes, it is.
So I'm talking about the United States. It's not. You can't say it's linked into it. The media are part of the corporate system, so they're not linked to it. So the major media are themselves huge corporations, mostly part of mega corporations. Furthermore, if you think of the media as a business, which is what they are, like every other business, they sell a product to a market. The market is other corporations, advertisers. That's what finances them. So the media are selling a product, namely audiences, to other businesses. And they're very tightly interacting with the government. There's a flow of people, a lot of pressure, and so on. So it's a very concentrated system of concentrated power, partly state power, partly corporate power. And we should remember that corporations are tyrannies. Corporations are about the closest that humans have come to the totalitarian model.
Yes, indeed they are. And they are the twin evils that you could have said would be communism and corporatism.
Yes,
corporatism will never be defeated.
Well, in fact, there used to be genuine conservatives. They barely exist anymore.
Yes.
But if you go back a century, when corporations were given incredible rights by the courts, conservatives were appalled. They regarded this, in fact, as a kind of communism.
Yes.
As a return to feudalism.
Yes.
Because they're providing private tyrannies, unaccountable private tyrannies, with the rights of human beings.
And that very plausible phrase that was used, a share-owning democracy, is in fact...
It's a total fraud.
I bought into it.
Well, take a look at stock ownership.
Of course.
I mean, we have the figures for the United States. I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like half of the stocks are owned by 1%, and most of them by the top 0.5%.
Yes.
For most of the population, it's your pension fund may have some stock somewhere. It's a complete joke.
Let me ask you about, again referring to Irish attitudes, and I think Western European attitudes to the United States. France, where I have home and spend some time. People love American culture, like American people, but they detest something about the United States. We seem to remember a different United States, a different America, the America of Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy. And I read a pamphlet of yours, an essay of yours, about revisiting Camelot, which was the media name for the Kennedy White House and its time. Is the America of George Bush and now much more malevolent and dangerous than that sort of tapia-scented Kennedy, Martin Luther King time of 50 years ago?
Well, again, I'd like to distinguish the state from the country,
yes,
always. So we're talking about the state. answer is a very narrow political spectrum. The Bush administration is at an extreme end of it, but it's not very different. So the Kennedy administration was responsible for horrifying atrocities.
Yes, in Latin America.
Terrorism, violence. It brought the world very close to nuclear war. Let's take Martin Luther King. The Kennedy administration didn't support King.
No.
They were finally forced to by public opinion. And then King was, right now is the, we're just past the anniversary
Martin Luther
of
King's.
King
Day, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes. But what actually happened with Martin Luther King? He became the spokesperson for the civil rights movement, mass popular movement. And as long as King could be shaped as focusing on terrible sheriffs in Alabama, he was greatly applauded. But not what he actually said. I mean, remember, the last several years of his life, Martin Luther King was trying to organize a poor people's movement.
Yes.
He was assassinated at a time when he was going to speak at a convention of a poor people's movement. Well, that was denounced. He was regarded as having gone off the edge. He lost his credibility. He wasn't just talking about brutal Alabama sheriffs. He was talking about us.
Yes.
And as soon as you start talking about us, that's off. Not allowed to do that. So the Martin Luther King who has been created as an image is an invented one, not the actual Martin Luther King.
Yes, indeed.
Because he was going much too far.
Yes.
He was talking about poverty, oppression, serious crimes in the North. No, that's not allowed. There was an America at the time, and still is, of activism. The Kennedy administration was not in favor of it. They were dragged in kicking and screaming. I remember demonstrations in Jackson, Mississippi, where demonstrators were trying to flee the state police, who were brutally beating them, fleeing up to the steps of the federal building where state police can't go. And there were federal marshals there sent by Washington who were throwing them back into the crowd.
Yes.
Yeah, that was happening too.
Were you, when...
Just throwing them back into the streets where they could be beaten.
When you were young, Professor Chomsky, did you ever buy into the Kennedy era, which was presented so lavishly? Were you always a radical in this way?
Well, I wasn't a radical. I was a conservative.
Yes,
and therefore I was strongly opposed to the Kennedy administration, which is one of the most brutal and dangerous in American history. I can run through it if you like.
Yes, understand.
The Kennedy administration gets a very good image.
Yes, and there's a reason, particularly in this country.
There's a reason for it. The Kennedy administration understood that if you're nice to intellectuals, you're going to get a good image. So they invited people down to have lunch with Jackie Kennedy and talk about Proust and patted them on the head and so on and so forth.
Recitals in the White House.
And they got a wonderful image. Intellectuals love that. The Bush administration doesn't. There's contempt for intellectuals. They get a terrible image. But if you look at the actual practices, they're different, but not so different.
The future. America is now the sole hyperpower in the world. Economically, its political influence is massive in the newly liberated from communism parts of Europe. There is a division, as you know, between old Europe and New Europe is attached, and probably the majority of Europe now attached to the American way of doing things. Is the future bleak, and bleaker than it's ever been? Because of corporatism, because of technology, because of the declining numbers of people who engage with democracy, even on the level that you did as a young man, I did as a young man, the civil rights movement was able to happen because of.
Well, just I was not a young man at the time of the civil rights movement. I was a young man in the 1940s when I had similar critique of what was going on then, but put that aside. Is it bleaker now? Well, first of all, New Europe, the core of New Europe was Italy and Spain. They were the ones who were praised most enthusiastically as New Europe because they overruled overwhelming majorities of their population and did what George Bush told them to.
Yes.
Tells you something about how democracy is viewed in the West. Is the future more bleak? Well, it depends where you look. Not if you look at populations. So the 1960s have a terrible image. And the reason is because they had a civilizing effect. They brought large numbers of people, in usually passive and apathetic, into the political arena to press their concerns. The 1960s changed the country and the world. That's why there's women's rights, civil rights, opposition to aggression, environmental concerns, and so on. So naturally, they have a terrible image. In fact, it was even the name for it. It was called the crisis of democracy. People are becoming too democratic. We have to do something about it. So, and that's extended.
Can America return to that? Given
it's not a matter of return. It's more now than it was then. The major popular movements that have really changed the country were not in the 60s. They are since. The women's movement, for instance, is the 70s. The solidarity movements, which are something new in the history of European imperialism, are from the 80s, mostly based in mainstream America, you know, churches in Kansas and places like that. This is the first time in history that people from the imperial power have gone to live with the victims, to help them, to protect them. It never happened in Europe. It never happened in U.S. history. That's the 1980s, right in the mainstream. The global justice movements, which are ridiculously called anti-globalization, are huge popular movements with real North-South interconnections, something completely new. It's the late 90s and the early part of the millennium. Yeah, those are very important developments.
We, at this moment in this country, Professor Chomsky, have never known such prosperity. And it's hugely welcomed by most of us on one level. It comes, ironically, through corporations, American corporations, many of them, coming in here. Ireland, Irish people have work now. Mm. They have the things they dreamed of materially. Yet, of course, lifestyle issues are there and people are not having the time, the quality time, their families and all of that. It's very alluring for us, and we attribute most of it to the neoliberal economic agenda.
Yeah, and that's pure propaganda.
Yes.
Ireland's wealth, for some of it, Ireland, not much of it, as you know, Ireland's wealth comes from the state sector, not from corporations. It's based on information technology, computers, internet, and so on. Where does that come from? It doesn't come from corporations. It comes from the state sector, the dynamic state sector on which the U.S. economy relies, like my institution,
yes.
MIT,
yes.
Which is when I got there in the 1950s. Yeah, they were under Pentagon contracts developing computers. Computers and the internet, for example, were in the state sector for about 30 years before corporations entered on the marketing end. And that's the way the economy works.
Does that make you an old-fashioned Keynesian? A believer in Keynesian economics?
No, you're. It's the right wing that's the believer in Keynesian economics. They are the ones who understand that the state sector is the core of innovation, entrepreneurial initiative, development, and so on. The basic way the economy works is that the costs and the risks are socialized through the state sector, research and development, and then the profits are privatized. Now, corporations do carry out entrepreneurial actions, but mostly toward the marketing end, not the hard basic development. That's paid for by the public. Whatever you think about these has no relation to capitalism or free markets. So, yes, a part of Ireland, a certain part, not the rest, is benefiting enormously from the dynamism of the state sector in the United States.
Okay, let me ask you finally, Professor Chomsky, about Europe, the European Union, the concept of Europe as envisaged by the French, particularly the Germans also, that it would, if it developed, be a third force in the world. If you took the Chinese and the United States, you'd have a third force. It would be a united Europe. It's something that we reflect on greatly and are continuing to reflect on as Europe, European enlargement takes place.
Mm-hmm.
What's your view of it as a project?
Well, as a prophet?
As a project.
Project? Well, first of all, this has been a profound concern in U.S. policy planning since after the Second World War. There was concern all through the 50s that Europe might become a third force. By about at the end of the Second World War, The United States had about half the world's wealth, enormous security, incredible power, much more than today. By 1970, the world had become what's called tripolar, three major economic concentrations, North America, Europe, East Asia, then primarily Japan. Since then, that's extended. By now, Northeast Asia is the most dynamic, fastest-growing economy in the world. It's still basically Japan, but also South Korea and increasingly China, with links to Southeast Asia and India. European Union and China are becoming much more close. In fact, they became each other's leading trading partners, or close to it, last year, probably more this year. Furthermore, those relations are developing with South America. There are now South-South relations. The world is becoming far more complex economically, with the U.S. just one of many economic centers, more or less on a par. And there is a question as to whether Europe will use its economic power, which is approximately on par with the United States, maybe greater, and other advantages, to strike an independent course.
And we, I mean, the argument in Europe is basically between the social model, which is the French model, which believes people basically work to live, and the neoliberal model, which believes people live to work. And that division is between, I suppose, most strikingly, between the new emerging European nations, recently in the Soviet bloc, and between the Spanish, the French, British, somewhere in between, and the Irish going for it. Our Deputy Prime Minister, our tarnished Mary Harney, had a phrase, we want to be closer to Boston than to Berlin.
Well, see, again, you have to distinguish the populations from the government.
Yes.
In the United States, the populations are overwhelmingly opposed to this, overwhelmingly. Simply take a look at the results of public opinion studies. They do not want to live to work.
Right.
These are elite attitudes.
Yes.
And in fact, they have been, economically speaking, a serious failure. There are very good studies of neoliberal economics. The countries that have followed the neoliberal rules have suffered for it. The ones who ignored the rules have succeeded. That's economic history right through the development of the contemporary world. You take a look at the last 20 years when the neoliberal rules have been applied. The countries that have observed those rules, like, say, Latin America, which did observe them, for them it's been a disaster. For East Asia, which completely ignored the rules and, in fact, followed the model of the currently wealthy countries, they've grown quite rapidly. This is all obscured in, say, World Bank statistics and so on by putting them all together. So if China grew fast by violating neoliberal rules, that's called a triumph of neoliberalism. But if you disaggregate and you take a look at what actually happened, it's pretty much what we know from hundreds of years of economic history. The countries which did allow something like a market to function suffered for it. In Eastern Europe, where there's a lot of illusions about this, yes, elites think this is wonderful, probably in Ireland too.
Yes.
Take a look at the actual facts of the matter, an economic history, or the attitudes of people. So if you want to be like Boston, let's think what Boston, see what Boston believes. Now, the last 25 years in U.S. economic history have been unique. It's the first time in economic history in the United States that for the majority of the population, real wages have stagnated or declined. Benefits, which were weak to start with, have collapsed. 25 years ago, the United States is the richest country in the world, has enormous advantages. So as you'd expect, they had about the lowest working hours and the highest wages. By now, it's reversed. They're down at the bottom in real wages and at the top in working hours. Do people like that? No, they can't stand it. If you want to be like Boston, not the rich people in Harvard Square, but the actual people in Boston, yes, this is not what they want at all.
I think Irish people are actually beginning to realize that, me included. Professor Noam Chomsky, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you on our program. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.